Cyber hackers could sell off stolen HSE data for years is the main headline for the Irish Independent this morning. Above detail that a security expert has warned that the personal records stolen in the HSE cyber attack will be used for years to scam and blackmail people as they are sold on to different criminal gangs. According to the paper, Ronan Murphy, the chief executive of the cybersecurity firm SmartTech247, says some information was likely to be uploaded to the dark web today, just to show that the gang behind the attack still has teeth. Elsewhere on that front page, the story of the forced landing of a Ryanair passenger plane in Belarus after authorities there told the flight crew there was a potential security threat on board. Taoiseach Micheál Martin described the operation to detain the journalist and opposition activist Roman Pratosevich as absolutely unacceptable. The intercepted flight is on the front page of the Irish Times and indeed most of the papers this morning, but the continued reopening of the country is the lead for the Times, with detail that the government will make a very significant decision on Friday to restore society to its pre-pandemic status by allowing the reopening of aviation, indoor hospitality and sport and live cultural events by the end of July. Reopening is the main news for the Irish Daily Star this morning too, which focuses on publicans' calls for indoor drinking to be allowed from the beginning of that month. 1st of July is the headline there. Across pages 2 and 3 of The Independent, the writer Sophie White reflects on the Deirdre Morley case and her own personal experience of being a mother with bipolar 2 disorder. In the piece, which was originally published on the Rogue Collective website, Sophie argues that action must be taken to improve our mental health services now. She writes, "Depression and anxiety get a lot of space in the cultural conversation because often people with these illnesses can advocate for themselves to a degree, and that's right and good. However, other illnesses are so often sidelined in the awareness campaigns. I've sat in hospitals with people who were unable to hold a conversation, much less speak about their experiences, and they are so erased from this conversation." Housing plan will have no impact for years is the page one lead for the Irish Examiner. Paul Hosford writes that the government's plan to protect home buyers from competing with institutional investors will have no impact for up to 3 years, with up to €1 billion worth of homes pre-sold to cuckoo funds. And elsewhere on that front page, the Examiner reports that the Ombudsman for Children has strongly criticised a local authority over conditions at a halting site, which are described as shocking and deplorable. In a report called No End in Sight, several children characterised their living circumstances there. One said, "Walking up to school, you see all the rats. They would be running up and down the walls of the trailer." And finally, the lead photograph for the Irish Times this morning shows happy-looking fans sticking their heads out of an attic window near Pearse Stadium in Salthill to watch the Galway footballers beat Roscommon yesterday. In his match report, Keith Duggan writes that it was not a game that will be spoken of in 20 days, let alone 20 years. But for Galway, it was just the tonic.
A hijacking, a shocking act. That is how the EU and the United States reacted to last night's forced landing of a Ryanair plane in the Belarusian capital, Minsk. The plane was en route from Athens to Vilnius at the time. Belarusian authorities scrambled a fighter jet and diverted it to the country's capital. After it landed, they arrested 26-year-old Roman Pratosevich, a journalist who played a key role for the opposition in last year's election, which was widely seen as rigged in favour of dictator Alexander Lukashenko. Well, this passenger spoke to reporters on arrival in the Lithuanian capital, Vilnius.
The Oman came in and they have arrested him.
Did they use any physical force?
Of course. Well,
have they been equipped with weapon or anything?
Yes,
like this?
And we all were being checked, and they were standing in front of us with guns, and they were just. Well, we didn't know what to do because they were checking our suitcases, but at the same time, they were arresting the journalist, the guy.
Well, a description there of some of what took place on that flight yesterday. We're joined now by Belarusian journalist Alex Znatkevich of Radio Free Europe. He's based in Prague. Alex, thank you for joining us this morning. Will you go through how events unfolded yesterday?
Well, officially, by the Belarusian authorities, the version is they got the report that there's a bomb on the plane at the time when the plane was flying over Belarus. And it was already close to the Lithuanian border. It was even closer to Vilnius, much closer than to go back to Minsk. But the decision was taken apparently by the Belarusian authorities themselves, because the Lithuanian air controllers say it was the decision by the Belarusian authorities specifically to land the plane in Minsk, not to allow it to go to Vilnius. And there was a military plane that followed the passenger plane, and they forced it to land in Minsk. Also, according to the Belarusian authorities, there was some conflict on board, but the people on the plane do not confirm this information. So, officially, the criminal case has been opened about a false information about bombing on the plane. But many people suspect that it was just a pretext to land the plane and to arrest Roman Protasevich.
And there were reports, weren't there, of Mr. Protasevich looking extremely worried and extremely nervous when he heard that the plane was diverting to Minsk.
Yes, that's true. And also his colleagues reported that he had contacted them from Athens in Greece when he was landing on the plane. And at that time, he said that there was some suspicious person trying to photograph his documents in the Athens airport.
Who is he, Alex? Who is Roman Protasevich?
He is a guy who was the editor-in-chief of a very popular Telegram messenger information channel. Several months, he's already not with that channel. He's with another Telegram channel, which is also on the list considered to be extremist channels by the Belarusian authorities. And they've reported very much on the protests last year after the elections, which many people consider rigged, and there were many documented evidence that they were rigged. And people protested for several months. At the height, there were hundreds of thousands of people in the streets in the capital, Minsk, and all around the country. And at that time, these channels played an important role, because for several days after the elections, the authorities blocked the whole internet traffic in the country. And Telegram is very difficult to block, so people were communicating through Telegram channels, and they were sending the information to these channels, and these channels were reporting on the protests.
Is there any indication at this point where he is at the moment?
I cannot tell you precisely. My guess would be he is at the KGB prison, because he is on the list of people supposedly connected to terrorist activities. He's charged with several crimes. These articles do not... The articles he's charged with at the moment, they do not presuppose death penalty, although it's still, Belarus is one of the countries that still has death penalty and the only country in Europe that still regularly enforces death penalty. But so far, the articles, the criminal charges he has, they suggest it's going to be up to 15 years in prison if he's found guilty.
Yes, he was reported as saying on the flight that when he heard it was being diverted to Minsk that they could kill him, he could face the death penalty in Belarus. And those elections last year, and they were widely seen in the international community as having been rigged. There were widespread protests following them almost every day, every week. And the crackdown on the opposition and the crackdown on dissent there, has that tightened even further since those elections, Alex?
Oh, yes, very much. Every week, every day, there are trials now, and people are getting sentenced, and some of the sentences are really harsh. Several weeks ago, there was a court trial of a captain in the armed forces who gave to this specific Telegram channel, which Roman Protasevich had been the chief editor, he gave the information about the use of armed forces against the protesters. And this captain in the military forces was sentenced to 18 years for high treason for that, for giving this information to the Telegram channel.
Well, look, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're grateful to you, Alex Natkevich there of Radio Free Europe, joining us this morning from Prague.
The cyber criminals who attacked the HSE's computer systems have threatened to release personal data online from today. if no ransom is paid. The hackers, believed to be a Russian organized crime group, have been holding on to sensitive data for 10 days now. The disruption to the HSE's IT system has resulted in thousands of appointments being cancelled since the ransomware attack. We can talk now to Ryan Gallagher, investigative reporter on the Bloomberg cyber security team, who has been covering this story. Ryan, good morning and thank you for talking to us.
Hi there, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Is there any evidence at this point, Ryan, that the attackers have uploaded the stolen data online?
No, not as up, as recently as a couple of minutes ago before I came on the phone, I checked. And they haven't. There hasn't been any update. I've looked on the dark web where these guys usually post information that they've stolen from companies or organizations they target, and they haven't put up any HSC documents as far as I can see this morning.
Where is the information likely to appear first? I mean, people, when they log on to their Facebook accounts or their social media or they Google their names, are they likely to see their personal data on the mainstream web?
No, it's more likely that this group they go under the name Conti or Wizard Spider would post it on the dark web. So that's not accessible with the normal internet browser. You need a certain specialist kind of browser that's called Tor, and they have a website on there that they post stolen information on there, and that's probably where it would be most likely to appear. The alternative is that this gang would actually sell the information, and in the case that they sell it, it might never appear on the dark web. It might be used by another criminal group for example, fraud or identity theft. So we wouldn't actually know in that case until you started seeing cases like that come up of people getting identity theft and all that.
Yes, and what kind of information then is likely to be sold? What would be of value to these other criminal organisations that deal in this kind of information?
Well, it'd probably be personal information, and details about people's their names, addresses, dates of birth, where national insurance number in the UK would be the sort of equivalent. These types of details that would identify a person, and it could be used to obtain credit in their name or something like that. That would be useful information. In this case, what people would be very concerned about, of course, would be that their extremely personal medical information could be obtained by a third party. And I mean, who knows what that could be obtained, used for. We have seen in the past, unfortunately, cases like that being used to try and blackmail people to, approaching individuals whose data is in there and saying, we will release this unless you pay us money. So that's another really horrible potential scenario that could come out of this.
There will, of course, be heightened awareness by people about possible scams in the coming days and weeks. But is this a longer term problem? Are we likely to see the criminals hold on to the data for months or maybe even years before they start using this information?
It's possible. Unfortunately, it is a much bigger problem, and there are many, many cases like this that we're seeing again and again. It seems to be a sort of spike in it in the last couple of years in particular, and it does tend to go on and on. There was a case in Scandinavia, I think last year, where a psychotherapist's office had been hacked, and hackers were trying to use the people's personal files about their mental health to actually extort individual patients. And that went on for many months. So I think the fallout from this, it could potentially go on for a while, especially given the size of the amount of data we know that was obtained, which was quite a large amount. So these guys have obtained a lot of information, unfortunately, and there's a lot of different ways they can try and use that to make money, which is their ultimate goal. That's all they're really trying to do, is to try and get money.
The government here has said it's not talking to the criminals and says it won't be paying any ransom. But what's your understanding about the communication that has taken place between the authorities or their representatives here and the attackers?
Well, my understanding is that there really hasn't been a great deal of communication. I think initially, when the case first sort of came up, I think it was about the 14th of May, there was an initial back and forth where the authorities in Ireland had asked for proof that these hackers had obtained data. The hackers then provided that proof in the form of about 27 documents that showed internal, you know, medical records and things that had been taken from the health executive. And then the communication sort of ceased at that point. I think the Irish authorities have decided they don't want to negotiate, they don't want to pay any ransom. And so there's just been kind of silence until then. I believe the Irish authorities did actually try and send the hackers a court order, an injunction that was obtained preventing the publication of this data. And the hackers responded to that, I think, with just a question mark. I don't know if they understood the court order. I mean, I'm not sure if they really care about that either. But there hasn't been much communication, not at all. It's not been like a lengthy back and forth at all.
All right. And anybody who is thinks they might be the victim of a scam or an attack is asked to contact the Garda confidential telephone line, which is open 24/7 on 1-800-666-111. Ryan Gallagher, investigative reporter on the Bloomberg cybersecurity team. Thank you for talking to us this morning.
And over the weekend, public health doctors in the Midwest put out a statement warning of a rise in COVID cases in the Limerick area. We are joined now by Dr. May Mannix, who is Director of Public Health Midwest. Dr. Mannix, thanks for joining us on Morning Ireland. What led you to do this?
Well, as you know, we had a marked increase in our COVID case numbers over the last week, rising from 20 on the 17th, Monday the 17th of May, up to 51 on Friday the 21st of May. So we were very concerned at the rapid increase, and also that was matched by a rise in our number of inpatients in University Hospital Limerick, which went up from 2 on the 13th of May to 14 on the 20th of May. So both of those issues led us to put out a statement to advise people. It was quite apparent that there were a lot of large gatherings, inside social gatherings happening, and we really wanted to make people aware that this was the case, and to advise people that really we need to stick to the public health guidelines at the moment.
Yeah, and so what types of indoor gatherings were you seeing, Dr. Mannix?
Really a whole range, varying from birthday parties to end of year celebrations for the academic year. We had some celebrations due to the Eid festivities recently as well. So a whole range of indoor activities, really. So obviously that is a very high risk situation, and it's not the current public health advice either at the moment. And the other issue is that we're seeing young adults. So it's people in their, you know, 30s and 40s, parents of young children, and they are the ones being hospitalised. Luckily, obviously, our older age group is now immunised, so thankfully we're not seeing that group being hospitalised or infected to any large extent, but it is the younger adults at this point in time.
Yes, and worrying, as you say, that there has been a corresponding rise in inpatients as well. At this stage, is it known what variant of the virus is doing the spreading?
Well, I suppose from the whole genome sequencing that has been done for the Midwest, and there is ongoing sequencing obviously across the country, our most common variant is the UK variant, the B1117. Obviously, we have asked in the current rise that all the samples from the Limerick area be sequenced, and we will see from that. We have had very few a variance of any kind, to be honest, or so far, thankfully, have been in single figures for the Brazilian, South African, or the Indian variant. So we're hopeful that that there won't be anything different there. But obviously, we have asked for whole genome sequencing just to be sure about that.
Yeah. So what would you say to people this morning? I mean, vaccination is moving at a pace now. Presumably, your appeal is to just hold on for another few weeks.
Exactly. That's exactly our appeal. I think our main messages are really please to avoid large gatherings inside to protect, you know, each other and the health service at this particular time. It's particularly challenging, you know, with the cyber attack as well. It's very difficult for staff. We're asking people, you know, if they have symptoms, please go to the walk-in centre. You don't have to have an appointment at the moment, so that makes it quite easy for people, and it's free. It's in the Ballysimon Road here in Limerick, and we're also adding, with the help of our colleagues in the Midwest Community Healthcare Area and the National Ambulance Service, we're starting an extra pop-up centre in St. Joseph's Hospital in Mulgrave Street, which is within easy walking distance of the city centre, and that will start on Wednesday and will be open from 12 to 7pm and is going from Wednesday to Sunday initially.
Okay.
And we will see if we need to keep it going for longer. So that's really important. The other appeal we would make is because we've had, you know, a lot of young adults affected and families, that spreads out into workplaces. And we ask people really not to go into work if they have symptoms. And please to wear masks at work, even if social distancing is occurring. We will be doing an information campaign for workplaces in the Midwest, giving out these messages. Okay. Starting this week also.
Well, look, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland. Dr. May Mannix there, who is Director of Public Health in the Midwest.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia, movement that inspires.
7:36 on Morning Ireland, and we say good morning to Darren Frahill. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning, Justin. And only one place to start. Phil Mickelson became the eldest man to win the major title in golf as he claimed the USPGA Championship at Kiawah Island. He finished 2 clear of the field on 6 under par. Padraig Harrington and Shane Lowry, though, finished in a tie for 4th place on 2 under after brilliant closing rounds of 69. Greg Allen has all the details.
The prospect of a player over 50 years of age winning a major championship has been on the cards actually twice in the last 13 years. But neither Greg Norman nor the cruelly unlucky Tom Watson got the job done. But yesterday, Phil Mickelson finally proved that age really is just a number in golf. How he did it was typical of the man known as Phil the Thrill. There were 5 birdies, 6 bogeys, just 7 pars in his final round. But early waywardness didn't faze him, and he settled with a bunker shot straight into the hole for birdie on the 5th. And after that, he drove on as his main challengers Brooks Koepka and Louis Oosthuizen fell away. Carrying a 5-shot lead into the final 6 holes, Mickelson coaxed his way home to win by 2 shots on 6 under with a round of 73.
I believed I had the ability to do it. I have not played the way I knew I could. It is so fulfilling and rewarding, and this is a moment that I will cherish forever.
There was a strong Irish final day story as 49-year-old Padraig Harrington and his good pal Shane Lowry, playing alongside each other, seemed to drive each other on to matching rounds of 69, both finishing tied for 4th place on 2 under. And Harrington was asked afterwards if he was inspired by his own performance and that of Mickelson's to think that there might be a 4th major victory in him.
We all dream it can happen, and it keeps me getting up in the morning, keeps me practicing, so this does add a bit of confidence. Yeah, I could be as physically good a player as I ever was, but there's a lot more competition these days.
Meanwhile, for Rory McIlroy, an erratic final round of 72 left him well back on 5 over par.
Yeah, lots more on that golf a little bit later on in the programme. In Gaelic, in hurling, was round up the weekend's Gaelic Games now, and the All-Ireland Hurling Champions Limerick lost for a 2nd successive weekend in the Allianz Hurling League. They lost to Waterford. Limerick had 2 players sent off in that game, one very close to the end. Also wins for Clare, Cork and Westmeath. But last week we saw Limerick lose their first match since July 2019, and their manager John Kiely, though, not too concerned a side have lost again when he spoke to Pádraig Lodge.
So, first half I thought we played extremely well. We controlled the game for long parts in the first half. Could have been possibly a little bit more efficient in front of goals and been a couple of more points up at half time, which would have put greater pressure on Waterford coming out after the break. And Waterford got off to a really flying start at the second half. But we kept our heads, kept our composure, brought ourselves back into the game again. And, you know, I think it was a really, really good game of hurling.
Finally, John, there was a bit of a hullabaloo during the week after your comments in Saltillo. You've obviously apologised for them since. Any reflections on that over at that episode, how you view it?
I know at the minute my focus is solely on today's game here and getting ready for Cork in 2 weeks' time.
Now in Gaelic football, Dublin and Kerry played out a pretty dramatic draw at Semple Stadium. Kerry came from six down at half-time and earned a deserved share of the spoils. Galway got the better of Roscommon. Clare beat Kildare in Division 2. Meath got the better of Down. Wins also for Louth and Antrim. In the Little Ladies Football League, wins for Donegal and Dublin in Division 1. Now, no changes at the top of the FAI following their EGM yesterday. Gerry McEnany re-elected for a second term as president. Paul Cook will remain on as vice president. And a new makeup for the board has also been confirmed. Six elected directors and then six independent ones. Among those names is Paddy Bonner. Independent chair Roy Barrett has been talking about the return of Paddy Bonner to the association after losing his job under John Delaney as technical director over a decade ago.
As an independent, he has a skill set in the whole high performance aspect of the game. But as you know, Paddy will be director like everybody else with the same responsibilities. But he'll bring a perspective and a fresh perspective, deep knowledge of the game, deep knowledge of the organisation, and also, you know, because of his work internationally and with UEFA, he has a very high level of knowledge around high performance, and that's critical for knowledge for the organisation. From a financial perspective, there's a lot more stability. From a management perspective, we have a new CEO in Jonathan, who's been there for 6 months. He's very good, bringing a lot of energy and knowledge and experience to his position, and he will lead the management team. And from a board perspective, we now know what the board is for the next couple of years, and our role now is really just to focus on the game, the development of the game, develop a new strategy for the organisation, a new vision for the organisation, and that's pretty well advanced.
In the Premier League, Manchester City officially crowned champions, but Leicester City lose out in the race for a Champions League place. Lost 4-2 to Tottenham. They finished fifth, and the places go to Liverpool, who beat Crystal Palace 2-0, and Chelsea, who actually lost 2-1 to Aston Villa. Empress Josephine won the Tattersalls 1,000 guineas. Another great weekend for the Irish rowers at the World Cup event in Lucerne. I think the pick of them all had to be the gold medal for Paul O'Donovan, Fintan McCarthy, but also silver medals for Ronan Byrne and Phil Doyle, and for the pair of Aileen Crowley and Monica Dwarska, and another silver for Lydia Heafy. Sunita Puspore claimed a bronze medal. Jenny Egan won silver in her canoe sprint event in Russia. And finally, triathlete Karen Hayes was second in a top-class field at the Lisbon World Cup event to boost her chances of qualifying for the Olympics. I'll be back with more sport after 8:30.
There's a further easing of restrictions in the north today. Six people from two households able to meet inside private homes. Pubs, restaurants, cafes allowed to serve tables of six indoors. Hotels can reopen. Indoor group exercise also allowed again. The limit on the size of outdoor gatherings increased to 500. Museums and cinemas are reopening as well. Peter Rabbit 2 is on the big screen, but not on this side of the border. We're joined by Mark Anderson, director of the Omniplex Cinema Group. And Mark, you operate on both sides of the border. So, you know, a happy day for cinema fans and staff in the north.
Yes, Audrey, it's a tale of two cities, really. In our 16 cinemas in Northern Ireland, we'll be open and trading for business at 2 meter social distancing, as we had traded previously in the south in December. But in the Republic of Ireland, there's no joy for the cinema industry, and no visibility on a return to work. It's something that is now increasingly becoming an outlier in Europe, not only in the EU, but also in wider Europe, where we see that 85% of countries have now either open cinemas or they have announced reopening dates. And by the 9th of June, 90% of cinemas in Europe and the EU and the UK and in Iceland and Norway and Turkey, all of these countries will be open and will be trading, and Ireland, unless decisions are made soon, will be left out in the cold.
Okay, is there no visibility? Do you not expect to be reopening along with the indoor dining, for example?
Well, the most we have from the announcement of the last reopening was that we were told cinemas would be opening on the 7th of June. That date was announced. It was announced on on government, official government channels, and then it was taken away for some unknown reason. And that really was the most deflating part of the last 5 months, to have a date, to get energised about a reopening date, and then for that to be taken away, and for it to be put back into a wider sometime in June scope. Other than that, we've had no assurances that it will be June, or that it will be any specific date in June.
Will you be able to find staff when you reopen?
It's one of the most difficult things about this is that we can provide no job security to any of our staff members. We've lost a huge amount of staff. The industry has been hemorrhaging staff to other industries. We've lost qualified staff. It is a niche market, and it does have niche skills. And to lose all of your staff essentially to other industries, trying to entice and attract those staff members back to the industry without an opening date is impossible. It just can't be done.
Do you expect people to head north if they can, to cross the border to go and see a movie there?
Absolutely. I mean, Peter Rabbit 2, it's a great family film, but the industry does not want to be seen to be encouraging cross-border travel. But human nature being human nature, and for a day's activity, especially in border towns, and there are 8 cinemas in Northern Ireland within 20 kilometres of the border, I expect there will be a substantial amount of people that will be travelling for Peter Rabbit. And as the summer goes on, as in June goes on, there's Fast and Furious 9 coming out, there's a new Marvel movie, Black Widow, that's coming out, there's A Quiet Place 2, which are all really, really high IP content that's going to be exclusively available in cinemas.
Oh, you have been missed, that's for sure, Mark. Good to talk to you. Thank you very much, Mark Anderson, Director of the Omniplex Cinema Group.
Scouting Ireland appointed a new Chief Scout this weekend. The Chief Scout is the leader of the organisation, responsible for coordinating its activities. It's also a volunteer role. The first woman and the youngest person ever to hold the position is Jill Pitcher Farrell. She was appointed at an AGM where the membership of the organisation also passed a motion expressing no confidence in the way the board had handled disciplinary issues in the scouting body. Well, we can talk now to the new Chief Scout, Jill Pitcher Farrell. Jill, good morning.
Good morning.
You were appointed as the Chief Scout at a time when Scouting Ireland has been dealing with a lot of criticism over the way it's handled abuse allegations in the past. And then this weekend, the membership of the organisation passed a motion which effectively expressed no confidence in the way the board had been carrying out part of its role. Do you support that motion?
So I think the board need to really take on board the motion, and they need to consider it over the coming months. But my job is primarily to support the scout groups on the ground, and that's what I will be concerning myself with over the next the coming months and over the next 3 years of my term. I'll be working very closely with the board, of course, and all of our staff. I'll be working with the volunteers and the scouts on the ground to ensure that our 36,000 young people around the 32 counties of Ireland are getting the best service possible, and that we're promoting their development. We're ensuring they're developing life skills as scouting does, and that they're all getting a positive experience the same way that I have, and I have gotten from scouting myself. And I think it's really important that coming out of COVID, we continue to share ideas and resources, because we are already back scouting. We can have up to pods of 15 at the moment, and that in itself is going to be a challenge. And I think that's what I'm going to concern myself with tackling, because out of the COVID-19 challenge, it's really important that we support young people and their mental health, and that we continue to have a safe space for them.
The chairman of the board at the meeting over the weekend is quoted in the Irish Times criticising some of the negative voices coming from within the organisation, talking about the actions of a very small few who were being unfairly critical of the organisation, and about online and social media criticism of the board. Are his points valid?
Well, I think it's really important that people are able to express their opinions and criticise, and that we can discuss and dissent information. And in my campaign and in the past few months, I've had a really positive experience. The I've like found a lot of unity within Scouting Ireland, and I think a lot of people are very happy to see myself in this position now, and they're very positive about that. And I think like part of the Scout Law and Promise is to be honest, and if people aren't comfortable, I think it's fair for them to express their opinions, but I think most people are trying to do it in as positive and a constructive way as possible.
Okay, there was also a motion passed at the AGM calling for the publication of all legal costs incurred by the organisation in the past 3 years. Is that something that you would like to see happening?
Yes, that's definitely something I'd like to see happening. I think it's really important that we're as open and transparent as possible with both our members, but also with the general public as to how we are spending money, as we are funded by the government. And there's also an awful lot of people who, you know, fund scouting, the parents even on the ground. So I think it is important that we're very transparent about costs.
You're the first woman and the youngest person to hold the role of the Chief Scout. Given all of the controversies that the organisation has gone through over the past few years, why did you want to take on a job like that?
Well, I wanted to take on the job because, I mean, I've had an amazing experience in scouting. It's inspired me to be the person I am today. I've been empowered as a youth member throughout the past 13 years. I've found a love of nature that led me to becoming an environmental scientist, which is what I'm doing now today. And I think I really want to ensure that everyone is having that positive experience. I want to ensure that scouting around the country is supported, that our volunteers are supported, that they're understood, and that they're represented properly. And I really want to show what scouting is about now, that it's not just sitting around a campfire, but that that is part of it, that we do camping, that we learn about the Sustainable Development Goals week in, week out in our program, that we promote Leave No Trace, that it's about the development of young people, and that is our primary goal. Okay. And although we use outdoor activities as a mechanism for that, that isn't what it's necessarily all about.
All right. Well, Jill Pitcher-Farrell, a Chief Scout of Scouting Ireland, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning.
It's been a rough few days for the cryptocurrency market. It comes as China stepped up efforts to crack down on crypto mining and trading. As a result, most of the leading currencies have seen their value tumble. Bitcoin fell 17% yesterday, leaving it down nearly 50% from the year's high. We can speak now to Anne Hayden, lecturer in cryptocurrencies at the Institute of Investing and Financial Trading. And you're very welcome. Some negative remarks on crypto over the last few days have caused quite a bit of damage.
Good morning, Jill. Hi, thank you for having me on. Yes, as you mentioned, China and the US Treasury are announcing moves to tighten regulations and tax compliance in cryptocurrencies. We've had a range of negative remarks made over the last week. Elon Musk possibly being the most important one, because cryptocurrency traders would, you know, they would follow Elon Musk. They, you know, their main trading tool would be his Twitter account. But basically, Tesla announced that, you know, as we all know now at this stage, Tesla announced that they are no longer accepting Bitcoin for in exchange for their cars. And the main reason being that because of the impact on the environment that Bitcoin mining is having. So we've had a nearly 50% drop in most cryptocurrencies over the last week. It's been very, very volatile.
Let's take it back to basics, Anne. What mm-hmm. are cryptocurrencies?
Right. So, well, Bitcoin was created, the first one, Bitcoin, the mother of them all, was created on the 3rd of January 2009. So it's been around for a while. There's about 4,000 cryptocurrencies now. And really, the definition is the cryptocurrency, it's a digital currency. You can't touch it. It's not tangible. It takes the virtual form of a coin that you store in a digital wallet on your device or on your PC. The most important thing about them is there's no intermediary with cryptocurrencies. We've no third party. The transactions are person to person, peer to peer. They exist on all the transactions. The ledgers of transactions exist on a distributed and decentralized ledger known as the blockchain. And the regulation of cryptocurrencies is in that blockchain. It's the encrypted and irrefutable verification of the blockchain that miners will add the ledgers to. Complicated subject.
Yeah. And many people seem to be investing in cryptocurrencies for the first time now during the pandemic, with the largest demographic those under the age of 35. For people who may be toying with the idea, is there a way to safely invest?
Yeah, very good point about the age demographic there. Well, firstly, I mean, to safely invest, I'm actually running a course at the IIFT in June on exactly that, you know, on how the what's and how's and the do's and don'ts. The most important rule, and I'm not trying to be negative on cryptocurrencies, but the most important rule is if you're investing, be prepared to possibly lose your money. In other words, don't park it. Don't be investing money that you just cannot afford to lose. The discipline is what's needed. The other important rule would be really to devise in advance what you want to do. You have to set rules when you do this, and you really want to know what your strategy is in advance. And to keep discipline. You need to be disciplined at this market. It is very, very volatile. And I mean, lastly, the other thing is don't just look at Bitcoin, look at the other cryptos. There's lots of new emerging ones coming in with really exciting technology as well. And some of them are only worth a few cents. And, you know, if you fancy a punt in one of them, they're like penny shares. You could buy, you could invest a small amount and see what happens.
Okay, Anne Hayden, a very complex topic there, but we'll have to leave it there for now. Anne Hayden, lecturer in cryptocurrencies at the Institute of Investing and Financial Trading. Thanks for joining us.
Cyber hackers could sell off stolen HSE data for years is the main headline for the Irish Independent this morning. Above detail that a security expert has warned that the personal records stolen in the HSE cyber attack will be used for years to scam and blackmail people as they are sold on to different criminal gangs. The paper quotes Ronan Murphy, the chief executive of the cybersecurity firm SmartTech 24/7, who says some information was likely to be uploaded to the dark web today just to show the gang behind the attack still has teeth. Elsewhere on that front page, the story of the forced landing of a Ryanair passenger plane in Belarus after authorities there told the flight crew there was a potential security threat on board. Taoiseach Micheál Martin described the operation to detain the journalist and opposition activist Roman Pratasevich as absolutely unacceptable. The intercepted flight is on the front page of the Irish Times and indeed most of the papers this morning, but the continued reopening of the country is the lead for the Times, with detail that the government will make a very significant decision on Friday to restore society to its pre-pandemic status by allowing the reopen of aviation, indoor hospitality and sport and live cultural events by the end of July. Reopening is the main news for the Irish Daily Mirror and the Irish Daily Star this morning too, which focuses on publicans' calls for indoor drinking to be allowed from the beginning of that month at the latest. Thirst of July is the headline there. Meanwhile, on page 8 of the Irish News, Suzanne McGonigal reports on the indoor hospitality businesses across Northern Ireland preparing to reopen today for the first time this year. Across pages 2 and 3 of the Irish Independent, the writer Sophie White reflects on the Deirdre Morley case and on her own personal experience of being a mother with bipolar 2 disorder. In the piece, which was originally published on the Rogue Collective website, Sophie argues that action must be taken to improve our mental health services now. She writes, "Depression and anxiety get a lot of space in the cultural conversation because often people with these illnesses can advocate for themselves to a degree, and that's right and good. However, other illnesses are so often sidelined in the awareness campaigns. I've sat in hospitals with people who are unable to hold a conversation, much less speak about their experiences, and they are so erased from this conversation." Housing plan will have no impact for years is the page one lead for the Irish Examiner. Paul Hosford writes that the government's plan to protect home buyers from competing with institutional investors will have no impact for up to 3 years, with up to €1 billion worth of homes pre-sold to cuckoo funds. And on the front of the Irish Daily Mail, John Drennan has the story that cuckoo funds are turning their attentions to agricultural land where prices are soaring and tax breaks are enticing. He writes that this latest twist in the property war between the state and investment funds has raised cross-party hackles, with several politicians concerned by the return of landlordism to rural Ireland, adding that the situation has been likened to a modern-day version of John B. Keane's play, The Field. And back to reopening, Gemma Tipton in the Irish Times spoke to Carlow County librarian John Shortall, who along with his team is delighted to be back up and running. He described that while the library is welcoming back visitors, it's also unexpectedly welcoming back some long-lost residents in the wake of the abolishment of library fines in 2019. People had misguidedly thought they might be fined thousands, he said, adding that there was one book returned from 1948.
It was a Ryanair plane en route between two EU capitals when it was intercepted by a Belarusian fighter jet and forced to land in Minsk. On board were 171 passengers and crew. After it landed in the Belarusian capital, authorities arrested 26-year-old Roman Pratosevich, a journalist who played a key role for the opposition in last year's election, which was widely seen as rigged in favour of dictator Alexander Lukashenko. The incident has been strongly condemned by the United States and the European Union, whose leaders will discuss it today. We're joined this morning by the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney. Good morning.
Morning, Audrey.
This incident yesterday has been described as a state-sponsored hijacking and the state-sponsored kidnapping of a journalist. Is that how you would characterise it?
Absolutely. I mean, this was effectively aviation piracy, state-sponsored. It was a, an Irish airline, a plane that's registered in Poland, full of EU nationals, travelling between two EU capitals, flying through Belarusian airspace, which would be absolutely normal, particularly flying to Baltic states. It was intercepted. There was effectively a warning given to the pilots and crew to say that there was a security risk on board. And then the plane was escorted by a military jet to Minsk airport, which was not the closest airport. The Ryanair plane was actually much closer to Vilnius in Lithuania, but it was essentially diverted back into Belarus, although it was still in Belarusian airspace, landed in Minsk, and then people came on board and arrested this journalist who was involved in the opposition movement during the presidential election and since in Belarus. And, this can only be described, as I say, as aviation piracy. And I think the EU has to give a very clear response to it. Otherwise, we're giving all the wrong signals. Fortunately, we do have a European Council meeting this evening, so European leaders will have an opportunity to meet and I hope make some pretty clear signals that send a very strong, make some clear decisions that send a very strong signal to a regime in Belarus that has no democratic legitimacy and is behaving as a dictatorship, repressing their own people, expelling foreign journalists, silencing civil society and human rights defenders. And now we have, an interception of, an EU plane full of EU citizens in a way that's just completely unacceptable. And, I think if there's indecision or weakness shown by the EU here, it'll reinforce in the minds of the decision makers in Belarus that they've done the right thing here. So okay. I think the response has to be clear, tough, and needs to happen quickly.
And I'll talk to you more about what you believe that should be in just a moment. But just a further detail on what happened yesterday. I read reports that KGB officials were on the flight from Athens. Are those reports true?
I don't know for sure, but what we do know is that when the plane landed, either five or six people didn't reboard the plane before it took off again, but only one or two people were actually arrested. So that certainly would suggest that a number of the other people who left the plane were Secret Service. We don't know from what country, but clearly linked to the Belarusian regime.
Do you detect Russia's hand in this?
No, I'm not going to make those kind of claims until we know for sure. I mean, clearly what needs to happen now is there needs to be an independent and international inquiry into what happened. But in advance of that, I think there needs to be a very clear signal from European leaders, as I say, as soon as this evening, that this is something that simply can't be tolerated. But we do have to try to establish all of the facts as soon as we can. But as you'll know, when operations that involve Secret Service personnel are involved, it often isn't easy to get to the facts quickly or sometimes at all of operations like this. But I think, we know enough to know that this isn't acceptable. And the person who was targeted, who is, an opponent through journalism of a president in Belarus whose election last August was clearly not legitimate. So I think the EU needs to act.
Okay, and you've said that they cannot be seen to be indecisive or weak. What do you say then to those who would accuse the EU's actions up until this point in relation to Belarus of being just that, and perhaps had they had a tougher response to Belarus in recent years, this could have been prevented yesterday?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure what they're proposing that we should have done. I mean, we already have a targeted sanctions regime on the Belarusian government and president. I've been involved in debates in terms of the decisions around those targeted sanctions. We have been strong and vocal and consistent in terms of our support for democracy in Belarus. Some of the opposition leaders, indeed, were forced to leave Belarus and are protected in EU countries. But I think what's needed now is a specific response to this specific incident.
And what should that be?
There are options. Well, I mean, you know, that's not for me personally to decide, but there are options, whether it's flight bans, whether it's travel bans for a series of individuals who may have been involved, whether it's an increase in the numbers of people who are named under the existing sanctions. But the EU and its institutions will have a clear toolbox of options in terms of the use of targeted sanctions. But they have to be sanctions that that will be noticed and cause concern in Minsk, because otherwise it's a futile exercise.
Are there any Belarusian diplomats here?
Not an embassy, but there's an honorary consul here, and I need to speak to my own officials first today, but I would like to speak to that person and understand very clearly what their interpretation of this incident is before we take any further action. But you know, we're taking this issue very seriously.
But would expelling all diplomats from Belarus across the EU, would that be a strong response?
Well, of course it would, but I'm not necessarily advocating for that. I mean, I think we need to put some thought into a response that will be effective. And it's not for me to prescribe what that response is on the radio this morning. I mean, we have we've already got very strong language from the President of the Council and the President of the Commission. Mm-hmm. I think they have signalled an intent to respond to this incident quickly. We have EU leaders meeting this evening in an EU Council meeting. Mm-hmm. So the structure is there to make a decision in relation to this incident quickly, and of course to commence an international inquiry as well.
Your counterpart in Latvia has called for Belarusian airspace to be closed, as have the chairs of the 8 parliamentary foreign affairs committees, including Ireland. Do you support that?
I certainly think that would be a very strong response, and in principle, have no issue with it. But I think the sanctions need to be fully thought through in terms of consequences. But I think this is an incident that is on the upper end of the scale in terms of something that needs a very strong sanctions-based response. I'd put it to you that way. And what I mean by that is we cannot allow this incident to pass on the basis of warnings or strong press releases. I think there has to be real edge to the sanctions that are applied on the back of this, so that we're sending a very strong signal that EU airlines cannot be targeted by state-sponsored aviation piracy, which is essentially what's happened here.
Okay, can I just ask you finally about a domestic matter to do with COVID and the restrictions, to do with international travel. Do you expect the EU's digital green passport to be agreed by July, and we'll be part of that, and international travel here can resume?
Well, I mean, first of all, politically, this has already been agreed last week. So it's really a matter of it's just a sequencing now of implementation, really. So what's been agreed is that the EU green passport system will be up and running by the start of July. That means that every country in the EU from that date will have 6 weeks to implement it. In other words, to have the data systems in place so that when people are traveling between EU countries, when they're traveling through airports, they'll have a scan code, presumably on their phone, which will be able to give authorities their COVID status, either whether they've been vaccinated fully, whether they've had a PCR test and it's negative, or whether they've had COVID in the last 6 months and have recovered. And then member states will be able to make decisions on the removal of restrictions on the basis of that data set. So I hope that Ireland can be an early adopter from when this is introduced on the 1st of July. I don't expect that it'll take effect from the 1st of July, but I certainly hope that we will be able to benefit from removing restrictions on international travel for many people who are traveling, perhaps not everybody, but for many people at some point in July.
Okay.
And we will be making decisions on that and giving more clarity in relation to it on Friday.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Simon Coveney, Minister for Foreign Affairs.
Children are living in filthy, overcrowded, damp and rat-infested conditions on a local authority halting site. That's according to a report carried out by the Ombudsman for Children's Office. Young children at the site told investigators about seeing rats running up and down the walls of the trailers. One spoke of feeling ashamed because of going to school dirty. Another told of sleeping in wet blankets at night. The Ombudsman found the local authority failed to consider the best interests of the children. The report does not identify the local authority so as to protect the anonymity of the children involved. Well, we can talk now to our social affairs and religion correspondent, Alva Keneally, who has been looking at this report. Alva, what's the background to this report?
Well, 3 years ago, the Ombudsman for Children's Office received a complaint from a traveller advocacy groups about conditions at a halting site where 66 children and their families were living. And 11 families at the site made a formal complaint on several grounds. And they included a persistent problem with rodent infestation, inadequate sanitation, extreme overcrowding, a high rate of childhood illness caused by living conditions, no amenities or safe play areas for the children, and housing applications for some families not being progressed. So the Ombudsman for Children's team, they investigated the complaints made by the families and visited the site on a number of occasions to talk to the children and to see the situation for themselves.
And what did they find?
Well, during their visits, the team spoke to 17 children. They got them to show them around the site, where they live, where they sleep, where they play. The report states that the team observed overcrowding, with children sleeping on makeshift beds, cramped into living or dining spaces. There was evidence of damp on the walls and the ceilings of the mobile units. The report notes that children walking and playing in areas where it was described as where there was an abundance of rubbish. It also notes the ongoing rodent problem at the site, which has been ongoing for many years, relating to waste management. One of the children, who's 12 years old, she told inspectors that walking up to school, you see all the rats and they'd be running up and down the walls of the trailer. And several children showed the investigators a shortcut that they take to school, and the passage, it gets muddy. So this in turn results in muddied shoes and clothing, which the children described as a particular problem going to and from school. And they felt it drew negative and unwanted attention from their peers. And given the overcrowded conditions at the site, sanitation isn't easily accessible. There are 140 people using the toilets and washing facilities designed for 40 people. And residents say this has led to stress and tension and at times conflict.
And Alva, what does the report then say about the role of the local authority?
Well, this site was established by the local authority in question 32 years ago, and originally there were 10 authorised bays. What happened was more people moved in and their families expanded. Now, they're described as unauthorised residents in the report. So the site has been overcrowded for some time, and the traveller advocacy group that brought the complaint on behalf of the children and their families told the Ombudsman's team that they were exhausted by efforts over the years to try and make things better, and that getting improvements on the site were in vain. Spain. So the report also gives an insight into tensions between the local authority and those living on the halting site. The local authority said there was resident hostility towards its staff, its contractors and service providers, with some residents, it said, refusing contractor access to the site to collect the likes of waste and make essential electrical, health and safety repairs and upgrade work. I think it's fair to say, reading the report, that, you know, trust has broken down on both sides. And those that are caught in the middle, really, are the children.
You mentioned, Alva, that the report addresses overcrowding on the site. And the investigation also went into the provision of housing for those on the site. What did they find?
One of the complaints from the families was that housing was not being progressed for them, and the local authority advised the Ombudsman's office that they faced two major issues in relation to rehousing families. One was that many of the families would not consider any houses outside their preferred area, according to the local authority. And the authority told the investigation team that, you know, it didn't have sufficient housing stock to meet this desire. Secondly, they said that the families have been slow to engage with choice-based letting, that this choice-based letting system. And what that is basically an online scheme for individuals to express interest in housing stock in a preferred area. Now, this was introduced by the local authority in November 2015. But if, for example, you've no internet and this site doesn't have any internet and there are literacy skills to contend with, well, there's going to be slow engagement. So the local authority said it has an office where the scheme could be accessed online, and its traveller advocacy unit is also available to help. But the Ombudsman report finds that record keeping by the authority regarding housing applications were incomplete or they weren't processed, which it says means that families may have missed out on getting a home or just didn't move up the housing list as a result. So it called on the local authority to immediately review housing application complaints made by the 11 families in question to acknowledge any errors and if there's any redress as a response.
And that review of the housing applications, that's just one of a number of recommendations in this report.
That's right. There are a number of recommendations requesting that the local authority examine its approach to housing these families. Other recommendations include a risk assessment in cooperation with the residents, including the children, to address the health and safety risks identified at the site. The Ombudsman has also called on the local authority to engage with the HSC, TUSLA and Youth Services to improve the lives of children living on the site. It says ultimately that the CEO of the local authority should take responsibility in implementing all the recommendations that are outlined in this report, and traveller advocacy groups, they have welcomed those recommendations.
All right, Alva, thank you very much indeed for that. Social Affairs and Religion Correspondent Alva Kennedy.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Go really electric with an EV or plug-in hybrid from the Kia e-range.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
And Darren Frehill is back. Good morning, Darren.
Hello again, Justin. And we're going to start with Gaelic Games and more fallout from those positive COVID tests within the Wexford hurling camp. As we know, yesterday's Allianz Hurling League game between Wexford and Kilkenny was cancelled as a result of three positive cases within that group. Now, two Clare players were deemed close contacts, and they missed their county's win against Laois yesterday. Now, Clare and Wexford played in Ennis last weekend, but the fact that two Clare players were considered close contacts has caught many surprise in this case. The Clare hurling manager, Brian Lone, has told RTÉ Sport he is angry and disappointed by the development. Lone claims it was members of the Wexford camp, managed by Davy Fitzgerald, that nominated his players as close contacts. The Clare players marked the Wexford players in question, but Lone feels they should have been deemed casual contacts. Brian Lone's been speaking to Damien O'Mara.
It surprised a lot of people, not just in Gaelic games, but in sport in general, because we would have thought that you have casual contacts in field sport. So are you able to expand on the process, the information flow, or how two of your players became deemed to be close contacts rather than casual contacts?
It was very unusual for us to hear that two of our players were nominated by two Wexford players as close contacts. You know, everything that we do, all of the protocols, all of the COVID-related stuff is so that if there is a case that you'd be deemed as a casual contact rather than a close contact. So when someone nominates one of our players as a close contact, No, there was a good bit of anger there and a bit of frustration as well.
I appreciate, like, we've all lived in a world where we recognise public health advice and we live our lives by public health advice, but in a process like this, do you have the capacity to question it or to challenge it? I don't know if challenge is the right word. Do you have a procedure that you can go through to seek clarity, or once the HSE phone call comes, effectively, are your hands tied and you enter into that process?
Yeah, I spoke to the public health official to make the case as I've made to you there, and look, she told me that she was responsible for public health in Clare, the Midwest, or whatever area that she was covering, and that she had made the decision. Once they were nominated as close contacts, it was effectively out of our hands or anyone else's hands. She did speak to the consultant on it, and he wasn't prepared to change his mind on it. So that begs the question, if, you know, is everyone a close contact, or how do you define that? So we're trying to follow the rules as best we can, and we'll continue to do that. We would like a bit of direction on those rules and a bit of clarity on what is a close contact and what is a casual contact in a GA setting.
So Brian Lowen has a question or two to be answered there. Now, I did talk to the Wexford chair, Micheál Martin, this morning about those claims by Brian Lowen. He himself is deeply unhappy with those comments. Unfortunately, not able to take a call. He was on his way to work. He works as a school principal. He did refute those claims and said he would be addressing them later in the day. In golf, Phil Mickelson became the oldest man to win a major title as he claimed the US PGA Championship at Kiawah Island. He finished 2 clear of the field on 6 under par.
And a simple tap in now for Phil Mickelson to complete history. At the age of 50, he takes the ball from the hole and the arms go aloft. He has become the oldest man in the history of golf to win a major.
It's my pleasure to present the Wanamaker Trophy to the player that beat the strongest field in golf, the 2021 PGA champion, Phil Mickelson.
We're going to hear from Greg Allen and his report on the US PGA Championship.
There have been peak moments in golf history which have ranked among the great moments in all of sport, like the famous Nicklaus charge in the 86 Masters, or Tiger's 2019 comeback win for a 15th major triumph in Augusta. And now this, Phil Mickelson winning his 6th major championship at almost 51 years of age to cement his place in golf history as a true great of the game. And it all happened on a day of a surging Irish challenge, while other contenders, like 4-time major winner Brooks Koepka and former Open champion Louis Westhuizen, almost seeming to step aside from the path of history that was being forged. Mickelson too had his own wobbles, and they were numerous, but so also were his bounce back responses as his inner compass seemed to drive himself on to this 5-shot lead that he had with 6 holes to play, from where he cautiously guided his way to a 73 to win by 2 shots on 6 under from Koepka and Westhuizen, thereby becoming the oldest major winner in men's professional golf history.
I don't know how to describe the feeling of excitement and fulfillment and accomplishment, you know, at this magnitude when very few people thought that I could, but there's no reason why I or anybody else can't do it at a later age. It just takes a little bit more work.
The Irish charge was two-pronged. Playing alongside each other, Shane Lowry shot 6 birdies in a final round 69, and Paddy Carrington at 49 matched that round, and they both finished tied for 4th place on 2 under.
It's amazing when you play with a friend. It definitely helped both of us relax and just play golf. You know, it's been a long time since I've been interviewed and being asked about my golf rather than the Ryder Cup. So for today, at least, I'm back to being a golfer.
And Harrington's added reward for his high finish is a place in the 2022 Masters.
Yeah, brilliant stuff from the lads there at Greg Allen reporting. No changes at the top of the FEI following their EGM yesterday. Jerry McEnany re-elected for a second term as FAI president. Paul Cook will remain as vice president. In the Premier League, the final two Champions League places went to Liverpool and Chelsea. Leicester's hopes dashed, 4-2 loss against Tottenham. And finally, another great weekend for Irish rowers at the World Cup event in Lucerne. 5 medals, more gold for Paul O'Donovan and Fintan McCarthy. An incredibly busy weekend and busy morning in the world of sport. All the other headlines on the RT Sport website. Okay.